Hi, this is Elliot Gould, and you're listening to KPFK, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles and 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara.
Welcome to Gray Zone Radio. I'm your host, Max Blumenthal. Today, we're going to be continuing our coverage of the Ukraine proxy war, and specifically the drama surrounding the worst act of industrial sabotage in history. That would be the destruction of the Nord Stream pipelines connecting Germany to cheap energy supplied by Russia. An article published by legendary investigative journalist Seymour Hersh has fingered the U.S. as the culprit of the bombing, meaning the U.S. has not only attacked Russian critical infrastructure, but it committed an act of war against its ally in Germany. Bombing the Nord Stream pipeline, or taking it out, is something that even President Joe Biden suggested he'd do, stating in January 2022, in a press conference with German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, that the pipeline would be stopped by any means necessary. Since Seymour Hersh's article appeared, much of Western media has done its best to ignore the revelations. But finally, in a report this March 7th, the New York Times acknowledged Hersh's bombshell in the 23rd paragraph of an article citing U.S. officials blaming a, quote, pro-Ukrainian group for the bombing. So it looks like the cover story has begun to seep out through a series of controlled leaks. I discussed the cover-up with my colleague at The Gray Zone, Aaron Maté. Take a listen. So on March 7th, the New York Times introduced the first piece of reporting based on controlled leaks emanating from somewhere in Washington. We assume U.S. intelligence, the White House, or both, attempting to present a cover story for the bombing of the Nord Stream pipelines. And this piece, in which it required three journalists to acknowledge that they did not have any solid intelligence or concrete evidence, blamed a pro-Ukrainian group. Let's show the New York Times tweet. Breaking news: a pro-Ukrainian group may have carried out the attack on the Nord Stream pipelines last year. Intelligence reviewed by U.S. officials suggested. Aaron, what was your reaction to that report, and how do you view it today, several days later?
Well, the key word there's two key words there. And this is a theme of all the Russiagate propaganda that we've called out from the start, is that whenever there's some sort of assertion being made with that they want us to believe, there's always, or almost always, a qualifier that underscores that they actually have no concrete evidence of anything. So right here in that tweet, there's two qualifiers. A pro-Ukrainian group may have carried out the attack on the Nord Stream pipelines. Intelligence reviewed by U.S. officials suggested. So that is a clear sign right there that they have zero concrete evidence. And when you go to the story, that's clear because they have nothing. They don't even know who this supposed pro-Ukrainian group is. The only thing they're certain about is one thing, is that the New York Times declares that no U.S. and British officials were involved. That's the only thing they're certain about. And that says to me, as many people have speculated, that not only was the U.S. involved, but British officials were involved too. Because why else would the New York Times still need to go out of its way to say, oh, hey, yeah, no, we know it wasn't the U.S. and the Brits. Because if they don't know anything about this pro-Ukrainian group, how can they rule out anybody else? They can't, because they're lying to us. And that's clear from the Times story, where there's so many times when they acknowledge they have no evidence, that U.S. officials declined to offer any information about what this intelligence says about the supposed pro-Ukrainian group. There's also a line where they acknowledge there's even a debate inside the U.S. intelligence community over how much weight to put on this intelligence. And then they say also they've drawn no firm conclusions from it. So on every key point, they're admitting they have zero evidence. And that's because this is a cover story to cover up for the actual role of the U.S. in bombing Nord Stream.
And I speculated that the pro-Ukraine group might actually be the one in Langley, which trains partisan terrorists within the Ukrainian military secret CIA training program in Ukraine, helped Kyiv prepare for Russian invasion. We learned that last year. This is the LA Times on the CIA training Ukrainian insurgents. The CIA has been training Ukraine's SBU and various, what you could call partisan or insurgent groups since 2014. They even trained a Ukrainian spy who was arrested in Russia, and the list goes on and on. And we also have Kit Clarenberg's report, which of course was ignored, relying on classified documents that were leaked to us. We didn't even have an anonymous source. We just had the primary material for everyone to see, the emails showing that the British Ministry of Defense and Military Intelligence was working with the Odessa SBU to establish a partisan army of saboteurs to carry out attacks on Crimea, including using diving and to attack the Kerch Bridge, which eventually happened. So, okay, we have all those possibilities there. Let's not totally dismiss it, but then more controlled leaks appeared. And first it was Die Zeit, the German publication, reported that six people crossed the Polish border with hundreds of pounds of explosives using fake passports and then rented a yacht from the German city of Rostock to carry out their mission to bomb the Nord Stream pipeline. So six people. And by the way, just one point I want to come back to is that the New York Times reported that there could have also been Russians involved in this pro-Ukrainian group. In other words, anti-Putin or anti-government Russians. Okay, so we have that story. And then Der Spiegel, the German publication, follows up. Der Spiegel claimed to have pinpointed the yacht. And this really just, this takes the story to a sublime level of hilarity. Investigators reconstruct the course of the sailing yacht Andromeda. The explosive devices for the Nord Stream explosions are said to have been transported on a yacht that was rented out through a charter company on Rügen, according to Spiegel information. BKA officials questioned witnesses on the island. So in other words, authorities were questioning people around the island because they were looking for this suspicious ship. So this is the Andromeda. Just take a look at this yacht. This is not Gilligan's Island. This is not a Christopher Cross song about sailing in the 70s. This is, you know, not a yacht rock anthem. This is not Fidel Castro's grandma, which launched the Cuban Revolution. This is the Andromeda, which supposedly transported something like 2,200 pounds of plastic explosives, six people, advanced equipment, including massive diving tanks, to one of the most surveilled bodies of water on the planet. They somehow knew exactly where the pipelines were, and then two divers dove 240 feet to one of the deepest points of the Nord Stream pipeline. They drilled through concrete reinforced pipes covered in rebar somehow. And then they planted the explosives in four separate places and blew up three pipelines remotely at a later date on this pleasure ship. That's the story we're being told now. That's the cover story.
And that report also goes on to say that the reason why German officials were able to catch them is that this crew of commandos, six people, just two divers, although they were able to pull off this massive act of industrial sabotage on that small little yacht, they forgot to properly clean up after themselves, because Germans, according to that report, found traces of explosives on the boat. Right. So all this crack team of commandos needed to do to get away with it, after blowing up this pipeline and getting away, all they just forgot to clean it up. So if only they had a good cleaning lady or cleaning person, they would have gotten away with it. For the fact they couldn't claim the explosives.
And for some reason, they decided to transport the explosives across the Polish border instead of sailing from Poland to Rostock, for example. Like, how did they get all those explosives across the German border? They must have the most lax border controls ever. And by the way, here's some, this is from like a yachting publication. This is the Andromeda. We can just like cruise a little bit. This is what the ship looks like that supposedly carried out the largest act of industrial sabotage of our lifetime.
two divers carrying out that act is just such a joke. You have to go, like, this is a really heavily protected pipeline. So you have to plant some really huge explosives, and just two people carrying that out in multiple spots. It's just hilarious. And I want to know, from the point of view of the people who came up with this cover story, why did they pick that yacht? Because they obviously knew that anybody looking at this from the outside would laugh at the size of that yacht. So was it a question of like they needed to find a yacht that was small enough to evade detection, or they needed to find a yacht that they could claim based on looking at transponder data could be placed in those waters? Because if you look now at the like OSINT people who are like on Twitter trying to validate this cover story,
yeah,
they're saying, look, we found it. That yacht was in the water. So this means, you know, like, right, this means this,
right.
So it's like, is that, I'd love to know one day from whoever came up with this cover-up story, why they picked that yacht, because they must have known that anybody looking at the picture would laugh at it. So I wonder what their thinking was, why they couldn't find a bigger yacht, at least to be able to say, yeah, this could conceivably carry hundreds of pounds of explosives and this team of six people of really highly capable, except when it comes to cleaning six
look
people.
At those, look at the size. I mean, you can see those parked in the Anacostia in Potomac in DC. But look at that. That carried out the worst act of industrial sabotage ever. I suppose one reason it was selected was because it was in the Baltic Sea at a certain point. But Die Zeit, the publication that initially claimed to identify this yacht and six pro-Ukrainians as the culprits, actually got the harbor wrong in which the yacht was docked. The harbor, the slips in the harbor were actually too shallow to dock a boat of even this size. And so they had to correct their story. It was kind of a massive correction. So, I mean, even the controlled leaks are really screwing up. And the OSINT specialists that I've been, some of the OSINT specialists who have been claiming Seymour Hersh is wrong, have been even pouring cold water on this story, just because of the amount of errors that are already there. And just the sheer ridiculousness of the idea that this yacht could have been somehow responsible.
Well, and that's a good point about Seymour Hersh's story, because going back to the Times story, that's the first time the Times has acknowledged Hersh's reporting, and they do it in such a dishonest way. They claim that Hersh, so it's the first time the Times acknowledges Hersh's story, like they bury it in like the 25th paragraph of the Times story. But they say that they say that Hersh, reported that U.S. was responsible. But then they say that to make his case, Hersh cited public statements from U.S. officials like Joe Biden and Victoria Nuland promising to stop the Nord Stream pipeline. So according to the Times framing, the basis for Hersh's story is public statements from Biden and Nuland and other people like that. No, the basis for Hersh's story, which the Times completely omits, is a source who gave him a detailed account both of the planning of this operation and how it was executed, not what Biden said in public. Yes, I mean,
right,
Hersh mentions that, but that gets like a line or two in his story. His story, which is thousands of words, is about how this operation was planned and executed by the U.S., and he's basing that on a source who gave him a detailed account. By contrast, the Times has no details at all from its multiple sources, from its multiple anonymous sources, which raises another interesting contrast. Hersh was attacked for relying on an anonymous source, at least the one anonymous source we know about. Whereas the Times relies on multiple anonymous sources who give them nothing. They have no details at all to offer on anything. Whereas Hirsch does have details, and the Times, being so dishonest, can't even acknowledge that Hirsch actually has a source who provided, unlike them, a detailed account. And then they have the gall to say, and this is my favorite part of their story. They say that their story, quote, amounts to the first significant known lead about who was responsible for the attack on the Nord Stream pipelines. So they want to tell us a story from them that has zero information, zero details, and acknowledges that their sources are unsure of everything, that their story amounts to the first known lead, significant known lead, not the story that came first a month earlier from Seymour Hirsch, which has ample details, unlike them.
And I tried to count the paragraph that the mention of the Hirsch story arrived in. It was like the 25th paragraph or the 23rd paragraph. They waited till the 23rd or 25th paragraph to mention Seymour Hirsch's story ever. That was the first mention. Yeah. So it had to come buried inside the cover story. But let's look at the big picture here. Seymour Hirsch created a massive problem for the CIA and the Biden administration and NATO in general. Seymour Hirsch has struck again, and he showed that you don't even need the prestige and legacy of the New Yorker or London Review of Books to do it. He did it on Substack. This story would not go away. I can tell you at the Rage Against the War Machine rally in DC, the main chants were about the Nord Stream pipeline being blown up. It was front and center in the German demonstration in which as many as 50,000 people showed up at Brandenburg Gate. And so this story was becoming a problem, and they just had to cook up something really quick. And I thought they'd come up with something better.
But that's my question. Did they actually have to come up with something? Because I thought things were actually working out pretty well for them. Yes. Cy Hirsch's story made an impact. Of course it did.
No, the silence was deafening.
But the silence was deafening. The Beltway media was refusing to acknowledge the existence of the story, with one exception in the Washington Post. The Washington Post did a story after there was a UN Security Council session about this, where Ray McGovern testified and so did Jeffrey Sachs. That's when the Washington Post for the first time acknowledged Hirsch's story. But otherwise, it was omerta. It was like a code of silence. And I think from the point of view of people trying to cover this up, if I were them, I would have just let that ride out and not try to come up, because what they did here was totally put the attention back on Hirsch's story and forced everyone to compare the two. And it's just, you look at the story they came up with, it's a joke. The Times story was unbelievably embarrassing. There's zero information. They acknowledge that they have no information. Then, you know, whatever, at the same time, that story comes out that you mentioned about the yacht in German media. And that's hilarious. Like this idea that there's six people on this boat, only two divers. It's a small little boat, and they get caught because they forgot to clean up some explosives on the boat. It's amazing. And now everyone who bought into the attacks on Seymour Hirsch has been caught with their pants down, because now they have to defend this humiliating coverage story that's been concocted for them, and they can't because it's so stupid.
Yeah. Let's get Seymour Hirsch's response what amounts to a response.
Yeah. Oh, this is great. So this is during an interview that he's doing, and this is him. This is a live reaction of him learning about the Times story. This is great.
What? That can't be true. They can't be that stupid. Are they that stupid? What do I care? I'm going to go look at the New York Times now. Oh, my God. Intelligence suggests Ukrainian. Oh, my God. Okay. No, I haven't seen it. No, I can't comment on that stuff. What do I know? I've written a couple of other things about it. I'm going to write something next week again about it. And that's the way I do it.
So he's going to write something again. You know, last week, it wasn't like I had some crystal ball on what I was saying was so profound, but I predicted the U.S. would throw Ukraine under the bus for this. It was based on Fiona Hill's comments, but you can go back to our stream last week. And I definitely called this. Other people were calling it too. And Fiona Hill, if you don't know who she is, she's one of the top Kremlinologists in D.C., very well connected. She was inserted into the Trump administration to harness Trump's instinct to make peace with Russia and pull back from that. And she actually reported in Foreign Policy last year, or early, yeah, I guess it was last year. She confirmed that the U.S. blew up negotiations between Russia and Ukraine. So in her more recent interview, she said that she didn't think Russia was responsible for Nord Stream anymore. And she thought maybe Ukraine might be responsible. Definitely the U.S. couldn't have done such a horrible thing because we're a shining city on the hill. And so that maybe, kind of set the stage, I think. That narrative was already brewing in Washington is what I'm saying.
Maybe she's the basis for this supposed intelligence that was leaked to the New York Times. Maybe she came up with the idea, or maybe she was told of this and she was just putting it out there to get, I don't know. But by the way, Fiona Hill also said that if Trump was president, this war in Ukraine wouldn't have happened. And she was saying that as a criticism of Trump, that like Trump wouldn't have been willing to stand up to Putin like Biden was. And so this war wouldn't have happened. And she served under Trump. So that's just a window into how these national security experts think. Is like she thinks it would be a bad thing if this war, this horrible war, hadn't have happened. But, you know, look, this Time story comes just a few days after Schultz visits Washington, right?
Yeah.
And that's a great example of what we're talking about, how the media was totally going along with ignoring Hersh's story. Because, first of all, what did the White House say right before Schultz came? That there's going to be no joint news conference. Well, that makes sense from the point of view of the White House, because what happened last time Biden and Schultz, Chancellor Schultz of Germany, had a joint news conference? That's when Biden, with Schultz at his side, blurted out that if Russia invades Ukraine, we will stop Nord Stream 2. And then a reporter from Germany asked him, well, how would you do that? It's not in your waters. And he said, we'll stop it. And he kind of grinned slyly, you know, and he was talking about, obviously, the plans he had already put into action to blow up Nord Stream 2, because according to Cy Hirsch's reporting, planning for that began not long before that joint news conference with Biden and Schultz. So from the point of the White House, why would you put Biden and Schultz together in, before the media again? They can very confidently assume that no U.S. media outlet would dare ask Joe Biden about Hirsch's reporting. But I think maybe they weren't confident that a German reporter or some other foreign reporter would. So that's why there was no joint news conference. And then all we got, and we can show the clip, there's Biden and Schultz sitting down for a little, you know, meeting in the Oval Office or wherever they do that. And the media is allowed to come in and take pictures together. And then Biden and Schultz say a few things. Like Schultz talks about how great Biden's leadership is, how he's such a wonderful leader. He's kept the transatlantic alliance going. And then the media gets chewed out. Like, you know, like, and you can hear Karine Jean-Pierre saying, get out, get out, get out, get out. And Biden is there just grinning because, of course, he's thrilled. He's not going to be questioned on his role in ordering the bombing of the Nord Stream 2.
That was my discussion with Aaron Maté of the U.S. government's cover-up of its role in the Nord Stream pipelines bombing. This past week also saw dramatic hearings before the Republican-controlled House Special Committee on the Weaponization of the Federal Government, which is modeled off the Church Committee that exposed heinous abuses of powers by the CIA and FBI in the early 1970s. The committee featured testimony by journalists Matt Taibbi and Michael Schellenberger on the Twitter files, which have exposed the role of U.S. intelligence and U.S. government agencies in controlling and influencing Silicon Valley social media companies to censor not only disinformation and misinformation, but dissident speech, including statements the censors have acknowledged to be totally factual. And as we'll hear in this discussion between me and my colleague Aaron Maté at the Gray Zone, the Democrats on the committee were not very pleased by the level of transparency. They reflexively rose to the defense of the government censors seeking an end around the First Amendment and viciously attacked the journalists in McCarthyite fashion. Some of the exchanges were frankly bizarre and at times hilarious. Take a listen. The display that we saw yesterday in Congress before the House Special Committee on the Weaponization of the Federal Government was deeply illiberal, in my opinion. And the illiberalism was emanating from the Democratic side, and it was being directed at two journalists, Michael Schellenberger and Matt Taibbi, who were there to discuss their reporting of the Twitter files, which we've discussed here extensively. We've had Matt Taibbi on. Great background for understanding what happened yesterday would be that interview. But Aaron, what was your reaction to what you witnessed yesterday?
That hearing was the culmination of years of Russiagate mania that normalized this culture inside, you know, liberal democratic politics, where any critic of intelligence agencies, anybody who dissents from the party line, needs to be discredited and cannot be treated with any respect, and should be shunned, because all these Democrats, not one of them were willing to grapple with the content of the Twitter files, you know, which show the extent to which U.S. intelligence agencies have been trying to censor online discussions and online information, and also trying to spread their own propaganda. That's what the Twitter files have revealed. And no Democrat on this committee was interested in that. Instead, they were trying to disparage the messengers, Matt Taibbi and Michael Schellenberger. And it was an amazing display. And they revealed such a McCarthyite way of looking at the world. And we have some clips that show this, but basically it came back again and again that the fact that these journalists, Taibbi and Schellenberger, dared to question our holy national security state meant that they must be disparaged. And it was an incredible display.
Well, let's start with Michael Schellenberger's opening statement. I thought he laid out the thesis that he and Taibbi were presenting, which is that the intelligence agencies have, the federal government was weaponizing social media to advance its own objectives against both the left and the right, using these kind of cutouts like the Stanford Internet Observatory or the DFR lab at the Atlantic Council. Let's just take a look at this before we get into some of the attacks on Taibbi and Schellenberger.
I would like to echo what Matt just said. I've never worked on an issue where so frequently while doing it, I just had chills go up my spine because of what I was seeing happening. I never thought in my own country that freedom of speech would be threatened in this way. And it's just frightening when you get into it. The most recent, our most recent discoveries, I mean, I think you understand the process, is that we first raised a bunch of concerns around the way Twitter pre-Elon Musk was censoring people and creating blacklists. Very quickly, we discovered that we had FBI agents basically and other government officials, you know, demanding that Twitter take certain actions. We now know that the Department of Homeland Services, which has had, what's that?
Security,
sorry, the Department of Homeland Security, you know, had to try to create a disinformation board. That went away after public backlash, but we now realize that they have this other enterprise and they've been building out basically mechanisms to proliferate a censorship industrial complex around the country to censor on a whole range of issues. And so you've seen this censorship industry go from, well, we're just fighting ISIS, to, well, we're just fighting Russian disinformation bots, to, well, now we need to fight domestic misinformation, which is just saying we need to fight against people who are saying things we disagree with online. That's all that means. And I mean, it's not a slippery slope. It's an immediate leap into a terrifying mechanism that we only see in totalitarian societies of attempting to gain control over what the social media platforms are allowing. And so, for me, it starts at DHS, but we basically see almost every government agency involved in this.
Yeah, it wasn't his opening statement, but it was, I think, a great dissemination of what Taibbi and Schellenberger were attempting to put forward, which is that the government is attempting to do an end around of the First Amendment. They start out by saying we need to fight ISIS propaganda. That was the justification for like the State Department Global Engagement Center. And in the end, it's just about silencing the speech of Americans on the grounds of misinformation or disinformation or malinformation, which we've always said here is just code for anything that interferes with the objectives of the national security state and the political establishment, which is really represented on that committee by the Democratic members. So let's start with, I don't know, which attack should we start with, Aaron? I mean, there's so many.
Let's start with the ranking Democrat, Plaskett. She, in her opening speech, it was unhinged. She accused Schellenberger and Taibbi of being a threat to people that oppose them.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not exaggerating when I say that you have called before you two witnesses who pose a direct threat to people who oppose them.
And what she's referring to there is, like, she said that right after she played a clip of Yoel Roth, who's that Twitter executive who was involved in coordinating with intelligence officials and all that. And Yoel Roth testified to Congress recently that as a result of the Twitter files, he had faced some threats. And so she's saying that that's the fault of Taibbi and Schellenberger. So for reporting on the contents of the Twitter files, they are now a direct threat to people who oppose them. But basically, is if they're sort of like architects of this effort to harm people who happen to cross them. It's such an unhinged claim. And what she was actually doing was threatening them and saying that because you're doing this reporting and because you're exposing censorship that we support as Democrats, you are a threat and we are going to smear you for it. And discredit your reporting by accusing you of something really, really heinous. That's what she was doing.
And for those who don't know, Yoel Roth was the content manager for Twitter, who was in charge of and like digital safety and security. He was in charge of basically determining which intelligence cutouts could come in and decide who gets censored and what gets censored. He made the ultimate call, and he often knew that much of what they were pushing on Twitter, like the Hamilton 68 dashboard of Russian bots, was fake, but he failed to inform the public or even challenge them. And then he pulled some drama queen stuff where he like left his house under threat in order to kind of cast blame on those who were scrutinizing what he had done once all of the Twitter files came out. And like, we get threats all the time at the Gray Zone. I'm not going to just leave my house and create some whole drama about it because of things people say to me online.
I'm not gonna accuse somebody who like whatever calls me a bunch of names on Twitter. I'm not gonna accuse them of like being a threat to my life. It's just like when you speak out, sometimes there are nasty people out there who are going to send you mean things. That's just a reality, and that's not the fault or the doing of journalists who report facts. It's such a ridiculous and cheap allegation to make. And then she goes on and has the gall to call them so-called journalists. And we have that clip as well. And it just speaks to the contempt and the immaturity of these people, that they can't grapple with the content of what is being discussed here, which is the national security state pressuring social media companies to both censor information they don't like and to spread their own propaganda. That's what this is about. And because Democrats right now have chosen to support that, here they all are calling two journalists who are reporting on this so-called journalists.
And to praise him for his work. This isn't just a matter of what data was given to these so-called journalists before us now. There are many legitimate questions about where Musk got the financing to buy Twitter. We know for a fact that foreign countries like Qatar, and to praise him for his
work. Yeah,
that's another thing. This is so funny. So foreign countries like Saudi Arabia have always invested in Twitter. Like before Elon Musk bought Twitter, Saudi Arabia, or like a Saudi Arabian billionaire, I think, was the second biggest stakeholder. You never heard Democrats complain about that before. After Musk bought Twitter, now she's raising concerns about foreign money in Twitter. And of course, she brings up Russian money in that thing, because of course, you know, that must mean that Vladimir Putin is controlling Twitter as well. But yeah, she has the gall to call Taibbi and Schellenberger so-called journalists. And watch her reaction when Matt Taibbi really politely responds and tries to correct her. He obviously goes out of his way, I think, to be really respectful and to try to treat the hearing with respect. But watch her response. She can't even look at him as he's offering her a very polite correction. She can't even look at him as he's offering her a correction. Yeah.
Sorry, this is the wrong one. There are so many highlights or lowlights from Plaskett.
That time was spent at Rolling Stone magazine. Ranking Member Plaskett, I'm not a so-called journalist. I've won the National Magazine Award, the IF Stone Award for Independent Journalism, and I've written 10 books, including 4 New York Times bestsellers. At that time was spent at Rolling Stone.
What do you think she's whispering in the ears of her staff?
It's like, she's saying, I need to pretend like I'm not paying attention to him right now, so I'm just talking in your ear. So just nod your head. That's what she's saying.
That's exactly what's going on, because she's getting dressed down, and it doesn't look very good for her.
Yeah. And then she goes to her phone, too. So she's got the ear, her aide's ear, and then she got her phone, too, as if she's so busy and can't listen to Matt politely correct her and calling him a so-called journalist and to list some of his accolades over his, 30-year career as a journalist.
She represents the Virgin Islands, which is like, it's like a territory of the U.S. So, it would be kind of unfair, but she's like a so-called member of Congress because she doesn't actually have a vote. She was laying out the contemptuous line for Taibbi and Schellenberger. And, you don't have to win awards to be a journalist. But in her mind, you have to basically be a stenographer for the national security state and the hegemonic liberal power in Washington to be considered a journalist. These journalists are not accepted. They're pariahs. They're to be blacklisted. They were accused of being a threat. Like, literally, their journalism was posited as a threat to the lives of people. And, let's watch. This is Representative Dan Goldman. And, the Democrats, they had to, I don't feel like they were completely on message. And Dan Goldman rehashes a lot of old Russiagate talking points that you've blown out of the water, Aaron. I was just laughing when this
testimony here today that you disagree with the two indictments by Special Counsel Robert Mueller that definitively established that Russia interfered in our 2016 election through social media disinformation and a hack and leak operation?
No, I don't disagree.
Okay, Mr. Taibbi, do you disagree with those two indictments?
Well,
how do you disagree with an indictment?
Do you disagree? They're about 40 or 50 pages. Do you disagree with the evidence outlined in those indictments?
Well, indictments are just charges.
Do you
disagree with the evidence included in those indictments? Yes or no?
I'm not on the jury of that case. I couldn't possibly say yes or no.
Okay, because you said earlier, I believe, that you did not see Russia. You could not confirm that Russia interfered in our election in 2016, that you don't believe that. Is that your testimony here today? You don't believe that they did?
I think it's possible that they may have on a small scale, but certainly not to what's been reported.
What's been reported or what's been included in the indictments?
Well, again, indictments are allegations. They're not proof.
And it's so crazy. I mean, it's so crazy. Indictments are just allegations. And there was Robert Mueller concluded that there wasn't the big Trump Russia collusion story, that it was kind of a hoax.
Pretty detailed allegation.
Aaron, you wanted to say something?
First of all, Dan Goldman is one of the wealthiest members of Congress. He's worth something like $250 million because he's the heir to the Levi Strauss fortune. and he also was a top lawyer for House Democrats when they impeached Trump after he briefly paused some weapon sales to Ukraine. At that impeachment hearing, that's when Adam Schiff said, we have to aid Ukraine and her people so that we can fight Russia over there. We don't have to fight Russia here. So that impeachment helped normalize in American liberals this need for us to sabotage peace in Ukraine and use Ukraine for a proxy war against Russia. And Dan Goldman, we can thank him for the mess we're in now, because that impeachment was about enforcing that consensus, the need to use Ukraine for a proxy war against Russia. And accordingly, because he is a diehard Cold Warrior, he is questioning Matt Taibbi and disparaging him for daring to not accept the every claim in the holy Robert Mueller indictments. And what's funny about that is two things. First of all, as Matt points out, it's a claim in an indictment. It doesn't make it gospel just because it's there. I mean, unless you're a dictator, you're gonna accept the premise that indictments can be challenged. That's what lawyers do, right? So he's daring. He's attacking Matt for daring to question that. And also, by his own logic, Robert Mueller doesn't even actually believe the claims in his indictments, because Robert Mueller dropped one of those indictments. The indictment of the Russian troll farm that he's attacking Matt Taibbi for questioning, Robert Mueller dropped that indictment. Because
they were going to get discovery in court because they actually showed up with a lawyer.
The troll farm got a lawyer in D.C. and they challenged it. And there were all these hearings, and the lawyer for the troll farm was showing what a joke this case was. It was an incoherent case that didn't even make any sense under U.S. law. And they were, and of course, all this is about a troll farm that bought some ads on social media that weren't even about the election, except at a tiny percentage, and that were just juvenile memes. And Daniel Goldman is livid that Matt Taibbi dares to question whether that amounted to interference in an election. And he's trying to nail him on that. And then when Matt Taibbi tries in that clip, in the exchange, to say to him, well, actually, Robert Mueller dropped that indictment, so what are you so mad at me about? He doesn't let him finish. He cuts him off and says, it's my time. So he won't even let Matt get out this answer that even Robert Mueller dropped that indictment that Daniel Goldman holds up as the holy word.
That's also what Debbie Wasserman Schultz did. And they don't want Taibbi to be able to say anything that will go into the congressional record.
Yes.
So they just constantly reclaim their time and don't let them answer. And let me just say that this, in the buildup to the hearings that we're going to be seeing on the weaponization of the government, which are run by the chair's Jim Jordan. He's right-wing Republican, affiliated with the populist wing of the Republican Party. He has his own agenda. There's no denying that. But in the run-up to it, we were told that Jim Jordan and the Republicans on the committee would be the McCarthyites. But what we saw here in the questioning of two journalists was it reminded me distinctly of the HUAC trials in the way that they were being questioned, because they're constantly trying to set them up as Russian puppets, as Kremlin simps, as people who are being covertly paid, or they were controlled somehow by Elon Musk because he has the ultimate say over releasing the Twitter files. He's the owner of Twitter. They were treated in a McCarthyite, straightforward McCarthyite fashion. I wanted to actually move on to Colin Allred, who's another Democrat on the committee, and just to demonstrate another line of attack, McCarthyite attack, which we constantly get accused of here at the Gray Zone, which was to call them conspiracy theorists.
I hope that you can actually take this with you, because I honestly hope that you will grapple with this, that it may be possible.
He's talking kind of like the dad at the end of Family Matters, you know, when he imparts the wisdom to the children. He's clearly studied this.
He's emotional. He's emotional about this.
Well, let's get that again.
If we can take off the tinfoil hat, that there's not a vast conspiracy, but that ordinary folks and national security agencies responsible for our security are trying their best to find a way to make sure that our online discourse doesn't get people hurt or see our democracy undermined. And that the very rights that you think they're trying to undermine, they may be trying to protect.
I love the idea of ordinary folks, like, I don't know, like the local milkman, like joining up with like a CIA agent to like censor journalists they don't like on Twitter. Like ordinary folks.
Nina Jankowicz is just a working class Broadway gal who's trying to do the best she can to protect us from the hate mongers. He had kind of an Obama quality too. Like,
really? Oh yeah.
There's folks out there. The folks out there trying to protect us from hatred, disinformation, and misinformation, and malinformation. Look, let me be clear.
When ordinary folks.
Well, he brought up, he brought up a swastika and a Jewish star as, you know, his exhibit, to kind of suggest that Taibbi and Schellenberger and the Republicans on the committee favor that as being the protected speech, that's what they're actually defending. And Taibbi did make a good point that, you know, in a free society that has a First Amendment, you actually have to defend people's right to be awful in public. You know, displaying a swastika in the United States is not illegal, as far as I know, under the Constitution. So he was coming at it as the ACLU liberal that he presented himself as in his opening statement, and the Democrats were not. But that's not what's being discussed here in terms of the content being censored. What's being censored, as Taibbi pointed out, is like the account of Telesur English, which is one of the best broadcast organizations in the world. It's a Latin American broadcast organization that is socialist oriented, based in Caracas, Venezuela. And so when the Trump administration attempted its coup, its corporate coup against Venezuela, they started seeing their accounts nuked, and Taibbi was there to defend them as well. That was just a political decision, and they weren't pumping out any hate.
And we should play that clip where Matt says that, because it speaks to all the people who've accused Matt of pushing this narrative that, like, it's only right-wing voices that are being silenced. He actually explicitly contradicted that. But going back briefly to what Allred said, Congressmember Colin Allred, about how we have to take off the tinfoil hat and consider that actually not everything is a conspiracy, and that our national security agencies are just trying to reduce harm and protect our democracy. Well, who's put on the tinfoil hat? It's people like him and other Democrats who have parroted the conspiracy theories that have come from national security agencies, that Trump was a Russian asset, that Trump was being blackmailed by Vladimir Putin, that Russia was paying bounties on U.S. troops in Afghanistan, that Russia was zapping people with microwave weapons, that Russia was responsible for Hunter Biden's laptop. All of those are tinfoil hat conspiracy theories. And where do they come from? They come from the national security agencies, who he claims are trying to protect people. And when people dare question those tinfoil hat conspiracy theories, they get censored. And for challenging that censorship, Matt Taibbi and Michael Schellenberg get a lecture from this guy where he's almost crying. That's what happened there.
Do you remember when CNN reported that Putin handed Trump a soccer ball at the Helsinki summit containing a surveillance device? Yeah, I mean, that's the kind of media coverage we've been treated to by those that Colin Allred considers legitimate for years.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, Taibbi was attacked also by the left. The left, meaning those sectors of the professional activists world in New York and on the coasts that fancies themselves to be more radical than the Democrats. They've showed either a studied disinterest in the Twitter files, or they've just straight up attacked Taibbi and said, oh, he's a tool of the right wing because he's appearing as a guest before the Republicans, and that the richest man in the world gave him all of these leaks, and so he's a tool of the richest man in the world. And they don't really understand how this works, but I mean, this is very instructive in countering that narrative, is just to listen to Taibbi's own words. And it was so meaningful when he said this, because we've been reporting this at the Gray Zone for years about the coordinated censorship of accounts of real people in Latin American countries that are under attack by U.S. empire, like Nicaragua, Venezuela, or the removal by PayPal of Consortium News' ability to receive funds, the theft of their funds. They did that to Mint Press as well. And Taibbi speaks to this.
Again, Ranking Member Plaskett, I would note that the evidence of Twitter government relationship includes lists of tens of thousands of names on both the left and right. The people affected include Trump supporters, but also left-leaning sites like Consortium and Truthout, the leftist South American channel Telesur, the Yellow Vest Movement. That, in fact, is a key point of the Twitter files, that it's neither a left nor right issue.
Yeah, exactly. And the right has been disproportionately censored and attacked under the old regime of Joel Roth and company. That's a fact. No one can say that conservative accounts were not disproportionately attacked by that Twitter regime.
Look at the Hunter Biden laptop story. This is a major story about the Democratic presidential candidate that was censored. People were not allowed to share the story in the New York Post by Facebook and Twitter. That's censorship. There's nothing comparable that's ever happened to a Democrat. So, yes, it's true that it's not wrong to say that right-wing voices are being silenced. The point is that Matt's not just saying that right-wing voices have been silenced. He points out some examples, Consortium News, Telestore, and Truthout. The problem is, so many of these self-described leftists who are attacking Matt Taibbi, they don't care about the censorship of sites like Consortium News. Because Consortium News actually challenges the national security state. And the self-described leftists who attack Matt Taibbi don't. And so they don't care that Consortium News is getting censored, because they don't see Consortium News as one of them. Because their club caters to the Democratic Party narrative, and Consortium News doesn't. So they don't care about a leftist site like that being attacked.
Exactly. And at the end of the day, they're just Democrats who want a better Democratic Party and fall for every ploy by the Democrats to keep sheepdogging them into the party ranks. And but that's why they use so much radical rhetoric, and they cosplay as radicals so hard, is to cover up the objective reality of their political behavior, the material reality of the U.S. left is essentially the street wing of the Democratic Party. And to a certain extent, the World Economic Forum, the pandemic really showed that. The real, there was some really just true comedy that took place. I love this exchange between Representative Sylvia Garcia and Taibbi. I'm not going to be able to do justice to it here, but Sylvia Garcia actually tweeted out one of the most embarrassing exchanges of the day. And it's worth reading it. She said, "To hide their inability to legislate, Republicans have launched a dangerous political circus. That sole purpose," I think she means whose sole purpose, "is to inject extremist politics into our justice system. I will continue to fight extreme MAGA Republican lies, misinformation, and outright conspiracy theories." So she thought this was going to be like, you know, her boss lady moment, and she'll be fundraising off of this. But if you look at that tweet, she's getting completely ratioed. And here's what she said and what she did, which I found totally unethical.
When was the first time that Mr. Musk approached you about writing the Twitter files?
Again, Congresswoman, that would...
I just need a date, sir.
But I can't give it to you.
This has her own logo on it, and she's trying to demand that a journalist present his sources and methods.
Fortunately, because this is a question of sourcing, and I don't give up. I'm a journalist. I don't reveal my sources.
It's a question of chronology.
No, that's a question
of sourcing. Because you earlier said that someone had sent you through the internet some message about whether or not you would be interested in some information.
Yes, and I refer to that person as a source.
So you're not going to tell us when Musk first approached you?
Again, Congresswoman, asking a journalist to reveal
so
a source.
So then you consider Mr. Musk to be the direct source of all this?
No, now you're trying to get me to say that he is the source. I just can't answer your question.
Well, either is or he isn't. If you're telling me you can't...
And Dan Goldman, the lawyer, is next to her saying, you know, why can't you answer the question? No journalist is going to reveal their source to a member of Congress.
Because it's your source. Well, then that the only logical conclusion is that he is, in fact, your source.
Well, you're free to conclude that.
Well, sir,
So that's disgusting. I mean, from the point of view of journalistic ethics, he's being demanded to violate them. And then she's posting it online as some giant own. Remember, Trump was always presented as like the greatest threat to media ever. Garcia goes on to demand to know why Taibbi didn't hand over the latest Twitter files to the House Democrats on the committee. She didn't realize that he had published them on Twitter, because she was asking, what conditions did you have with Elon Musk? And he said, the only condition was that we published this on Twitter. And she said, so you gave the files to Twitter? And she kept saying, you gave the files to Twitter first instead of to us, because she doesn't understand that Twitter is a place where you publish. She doesn't even understand how Twitter works. And yet she's asking all these hostile and aggressive questions. And then this was one of the greatest moments of the day.
Yet you yourself posted on your I guess it's kind of like a web page. I don't quite understand what Substack is, but that what I can say is that yet.
So she doesn't know what Substack is. And then she goes on to make some, to enter into a really bizarre line of questioning. And I don't know if this was even intentional or not, but she conjures up a really kind of like an image that I would never want to think about.
In your discussion, in your answer, you also said that you were invited by a friend, Barry Weiss.
My friend, Barry Weiss.
So this friend works for Twitter, or what is her?
She's a journalist.
She's pretty well known.
Sir, I didn't ask you a question. I'm now asking Mr. Schellenberger a question. Please,
yes, ma'am. Barry Weiss is a journalist.
I'm sorry, sir?
She's a journalist.
She's a journalist. So you work in concert with her?
Yeah.
Do you know when she first was contacted by Mr. Musk?
I don't know.
You don't know. So you're in this as a threesome?
There was many more people involved than that.
There was.
What?
Yeah.
Was contacted by Mr. Musk?
I don't know.
You don't know. So you're in this as a threesome?
Like, why did she say that? What did she think she was accomplishing there?
I don't know. But, you know, going back to what she said about the source of the information.
I just don't want to think about Barry Weiss in a threesome.
I've been your host on Gray Zone Radio, Max Blumenthal. Join us next week at Pacifica and check out our website, thegrayzone.com, for more of our investigative reporting, video work, and to sign up for our newsletter. That's thegrayzone.com. This episode was produced by Christopher Weaver.
To engage in any activity
that shall contribute
to a lasting understanding
between nations and between the individuals of all nations,
races, creeds, and colors.
To gather and disseminate information
on the causes of conflict
between any and all of such groups,
and through any and all means
compatible with the purposes of this corporation,
to promote the study of political and economic problems
and of the causes of religious, philosophical,
and racial antagonisms.
That is our mission.
On Sojourner Truth, we work hard to bring you local, national, and international news and views. We are one of the most cutting-edge shows on KPFK and on other Pacifica stations. Want to find out why? Tune in to Sojourner Truth, Tuesday to Friday, 7 to 8 a.m. on KPFK 90.7 FM. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
Donating your car or boat is an excellent way to help KPFK stay alive and on air. All you have to do is call 877-KPFK-AUTO, that's 877-KPFK-AUTO, and we'll take care of everything.
This is KPFK.
We do know that there is a price to pay for some of us who stand up in these sports leagues, because much of it is also driven by advertising dollars. If you are a major star, you have the power to allow people to be influenced by you to buy a product. So it is probably not true that most players are sticking their necks out for justice. So for me, when they do stand up and get in that lane, I'm always really excited.
This is KPFK
90.7 FM,
Los Angeles.
This is Stanley Clark,
Free Speech Radio can't survive without your generous support. Become a KPFK sustaining member now by pledging $1 a day at kpfk.org. Become a sustaining member. Your donation is tax deductible and membership has its privileges. I am a member, so join me, Stanley Clark, in keeping independent radio alive. Donate to KPFK at kpfk.org and do it today.